You're listening to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Now live in the studio, local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, the Saturday, September 22nd show. I'm Tina Mitchell, Mortgage Diva, and sitting to my left is my co-host, the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer.
Hi, Tina. How are you?
Awesome.
Good.
We have a great show today. Thank you for taking time with us today to talk money. Mike and I are here every Saturday on AM 1090 at 3 p.m., bringing in expert advice and the inside knowledge of how today's events in our local economy can affect your money. We're here to help you build a strong financial blueprint 1 week and one show at a time. Mike, excited for our guest that we have today. You want to introduce what we've got going on?
I'd love to. We're going to have Mark Peterson with Ameriprise Financial on to speak about the nuts and bolts of retirement planning, kind of retirement planning 101. And then we also have Jerry Bucola with Remax Real Estate, and he's going to talk about how to maximize the sales price of your home.
Awesome show today.
Yeah.
Let's do some money chat. And for Money Chat today, I thought I'd share some QE3 and break it down for us. Federal Reserve is expanding its holdings in the long-term securities with open-ended purchases of $40 billion of mortgage debts as it seeks to boost growth and reduce unemployment. Chairman Ben Bernanke said in his press conference on September 13th, "We're looking for ongoing sustained improvement in the labor market." He said the open-ended purchases would continue until the labor market improves significantly. "We're not going to rush to begin to tighten policy. We're going to give it some time to make sure the economy is well established." Bernanke, a scholar of the Great Depression, has deployed the most aggressive monetary policy since the Fed's founding nearly a century ago as he battled the 2007 through 2009 financial crisis. What makes this round of QE different from prior rounds is that the Fed designed QE3 to be open-ended. This means that there's no specific end or end date, nor program size specific for QE3, which gives the program a different feel from the original QE and the QE2. In 2008, you may remember the QE sized at $600 billion total. And then in 2010, QE2 sized at $900 billion total. In 2012, now with QE3, sized at $40 billion per month, specifically in mortgage bonds, again with no end. So the Fed will continue to buy mortgage bonds until it feels that it's time to stop, and that could be at the end of 2012 or anytime in the future, possibly even into the mid-2015 at the latest. So we could see the QE3 hanging around for quite some time. Now, here's my thought of the benefits of QE3. It could help keep long-term interest rates in lower levels and preventing any strain in the financial markets. Keeping long-term yields at suppressed levels would minimize interest outflow and also support the policy of financial repression. With respect to the labor markets, I don't see much of a potential benefit for the labor markets for QE3. The program is designed to bring further relief to financial markets. QE3 does not provide any policy trigger which would boost job growth. There might be a limited indirect benefits. However, they will not be enough to bring about substantial decline in the unemployment rate. On the contrary, declining to keep interest rates artificially low until mid-2015 suggests that the policymakers are increasingly sure that sluggish economic growth and job market will remain. So it's interesting to see what's going to happen. I think QE3 might also bring forward renewed fears of high inflation, which in my opinion is very likely in the next 3 to 5 years. So the central bank's balance sheet was already swelled to $2.8 trillion, and the current program will extend the balance sheet well beyond $3 trillion over the next 3 to 5 months. If interest rates do remain low until 2015, I see that higher commodity prices leading to inflation on households, this might be a negative in the weak job market scenario. So again, it's just going to be interesting to see how all that all plays out.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tina.
You're welcome.
Great information. As you remember last week, I touched on real quickly declining appraisals and how appraisals are really hurting a lot of homeowners, transactions, real estate agents, people that are trying to refinance their house. And then, interesting enough, I was listening to an interview earlier this week with Vera Gibbons. She's with MSNBC, and she was talking about ways that consumers can try to boost their home value. So I thought it'd be a good kind of segue back into what we were where we left off last week.
And we had lots of calls and emails that came in on appraisal value issues that people had.
Absolutely. And people were kind of wanting to know, okay, well, yes, we understand there's a problem, but as consumers, what can we do to actually fight against it?
Mm-hmm.
So she touched on this, and basically, you know, what she was talking about, which you and I know this already, but when we started getting into the, you know, where appraisals had to be ordered through a third party, we were no longer able to actually order the appraisal directly through an appraiser of choice. What's happened over the last couple of years, unfortunately, is that the amount of money that appraisers could make on an appraisal, it's almost like their income's been cut in half. So what you've seen over the last couple of years is a lot of the really top-notch appraisers that have been in our market and that have had a lot of experience basically leave the market altogether just because their income got slashed so bad. And of course, what happens there is you get a lot of more influx of new appraisers or appraisers that have a lot less experience now that are basically out there doing our appraisers. So a couple things that she had mentioned in this interview was, you know, as consumers, if you're going to go through and get an appraisal and it's actually being done through the bank that currently owns your mortgage, you can ask. Now, it's not that you're going to get anywhere with this, but you can definitely ask for them to please send an appraiser that has, you know, a high level of experience. Now, again, you and I both know that that may not work, but it definitely doesn't hurt to ask to make the request. I'd like to have an appraiser that has been at least, you know, in our area for at least the last 5-6 years, what have you. And they said that's a good opportunity for you to probably hopefully get, it's kind of the luck of the draw, but it doesn't hurt. The other thing is they were recommending that, you know your own comps. Do the research that you would do as if you were buying a house. You know, if you were going to go buy a house, you wouldn't just rely on what the real estate agent or the appraiser said. You know, you're going to go out and get comps. You're going to find out what other homes are selling for in your area. So they kind of encourage people to do, you know, get your own comps. Look for sales that have definitely happened in the last 6 months. A lot of times appraisers will use comps, but they're old. So definitely look for stuff in the last 6 months and make sure that the comps are apples to apples. So, you know, that the lot size is accurate, the square footage of the house, how old the house is, if there's any upgrades to the home, if there's any, you know, good schools around that area, if your house happens to have a good view where other houses may not have a good view. These are all things that you want to make sure you as a consumer are looking for. You can even go on to, you know, Zillow. What's another one that we use, Tina? Is it Redfin?
E-appraisal, Redfin. Redfin's kind of hard because it gives that low value, medium value, high value. And basically it says anywhere in the neighborhood, this is the lowest house, the medium and the high. So what's really good is you do Redfin, but then follow it up by Zillow and e-appraisal. And then you kind of have an idea that it's falling towards that high end of Redfin or the medium, and it gives you a really good idea of value. In our market, it's a little bit easier because we have tons of comparables in our main areas, so it makes it a little easier to support value.
Sure, sure. They also said, you know, call a local real estate agent. Everybody knows a real estate agent. Ask a real estate agent to do you a favor and come by and look at your house and get their opinion. They'll be able to, you know, very quickly pull up to see any recent sales. Also look out for things like for sale by owners, you know, homes that have maybe sold that never hit the MLS, but to try to find out what that home sold for. So do your research. The other thing too, they said, it's kind of interesting. They were, you know, appraisers have been asked, is it okay for a consumer to come to them with a list of their opinions or research that they've done? And most appraisers said they welcome it. You know, as long as it's done respectfully. You know, if you're a home buyer and your appraiser shows up to your house and you start shoving a bunch of information down the appraiser's throat and acting like, you know more than they do, they're not going to take that very well. But if you're very polite and you just kind of say, hey, you know, I've done some research of my own, and you just, you know, hand it off to them, you know, 99% of the appraisers will be very respectful of that and appreciate that feedback. The other thing too was, you know, if you've done stuff in your house, new AC, you know, you put in new windows, maybe you finished a basement downstairs or added a bathroom, things that may not necessarily come up on public record, these are things you definitely want to point out to an appraiser. You just don't want to assume that they're going to see all that stuff and know all that stuff. So anyways, that's kind of what the interview touched on. And the last thing is that people asked, is there an appeal process? And the answer is yes. Obviously, an appraisal can take up to, you know, a week or so to get done and get back to the lender. You as a consumer absolutely have a right to review that appraisal and go through it. And if you think that the value is coming in low, you can appeal it. There's no guarantee it's going to get anywhere, but there definitely is an appeal process, and you'd want to speak to your loan officer and have them help you go through that process. And I know that, you know, Tina, you and I both have had that experience where we've had to take
a few times, take
an appraisal and get it appealed. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, but the bottom line is, do your own homework and don't ever assume that the appraiser is going to be 100% accurate.
And I want to comment on a few things, a few points on that. And I think it's really important with requesting that they have experience in that local market, because there's so many times to where literally they're pulling appraisers in from miles and miles away, you know, which doesn't make sense because of the commute. They have to drive all that, but that's what's happening. Also, the point with calling a real estate agent, because most people that are in homes, they have a relationship with somebody that actually helped them purchase that home. And their realtor is always looking for opportunities to add value back to them and continue that relationship. So definitely I would pick up the phone and call them. Right. And find out what type of comparables that they can come up. And then the last point, Mike, I think is really important that you mentioned, was in being polite and being prepared for the appraiser. Just remember that the appraiser has an opinion. The value of the home is based on an opinion. And each individual is going to have a different opinion. Maybe one's going to be a little more aggressive on the value, one a little bit less. And definitely how you treat them and communicate with them on your preparation is going to make a difference on the opinion they may have on your home. So I thought that was a good point.
Yep.
And that was our money chat for today. If you're thinking of selling your home, you will not want to miss out on our next guest. Coming up next on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, we have Jerry Bacola with RE/MAX Northwest Realtors to talk about getting top dollar when you are selling your home.
Baseball, the national pastime. It's basic, simple. In a time when, for a lot of Americans, many things are not. Your local Allstate agent can help make things a bit easier by saving you money on car insurance. Right off the bat, safe drivers can save up to 25%. Are you in good hands?
Get big league insurance for less. In Seattle, call Allstate agent Brett Stenmo first. Discount subject to terms and availability. Discount amount subject to change. Actual savings vary. Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois.
Do you need to sell your home or investment property in the near future? When you sell, do you want to ensure a maximum selling price in a reasonable amount of time? Jerry Bacola, MBA, is a managing broker with RE/MAX Northwest Realtors. He has been helping clients just like you for the last 19 years. Jerry has a proven track record of pricing clients' properties accurately. This means that your property will obtain the highest possible selling price. Jerry follows up with broad exposure of your property on the internet, and this strategy will sell your property in a reasonable amount of time. You don't need to waste many precious months waiting for your sale.
Do you have questions? Contact me, Jerry Bacola, at calljerry.com. That's Jerry with a J, calljerry.com.
This is the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance experts Dina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. You know, the purpose of our show is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090 or at themoneyhour.com. So today we have Jerry Bacola with RE/MAX. Jerry's been with RE/MAX for the past 19 years. He's a managing broker and holds an MBA from Oregon State University. He has been consistently in the top 5 to 10% in sales volume nationally. His practice includes residential as well as commercial real estate. His 19 years of successful practice has been made possible by happy clients who refer their family and friends to Jerry. He's also been married for 29 years and has 5 beautiful daughters.
Beautiful is right.
Oh my gosh, 5 daughters?
Yes.
Wow, you are a lucky, lucky man, Jerry.
Thank you. Yep, it's a ton of fun.
Yeah. Well, welcome to studio for the first time.
Thank you, you too. It's good afternoon.
So I think it's a good topic. There's a lot of people that are thinking about selling their home. Maybe they're currently selling their home right now. So if you're listening today and you are thinking, or you are, you absolutely want to stay tuned in to our segment here with Jerry to talk about how do you maximize the price. So let's just start out, Jerry. What does a seller need to do to make sure that they're getting the highest possible price for their home?
Well, Tina, they need to do 2 things. It's simple. One is price your home competitively when you first hit the market. And the second thing to do is make sure that before you hit the market, you have properly prepared the interior of your home.
So it's that simple.
It's that simple.
Price competitive, make sure visually it's appealing to the buyers.
Exactly.
It's so simple, but yet so many people don't do that. Why?
Good question. Because it takes a little effort on the part of the homeowner to prepare their home properly. But second of all, it takes some effort on the part of the real estate broker. The real estate broker needs to provide a market analysis, and a market analysis that's written, That's properly structured and thorough.
Okay, so let's go into a little more detail with that. On a thorough market analysis, what would that look like?
Okay, what that looks like is your broker selecting between 5 and 10 comparable homes to compare your home to. And those are sales, and those sales should have happened in the last 3 months. And I say the last 3 months because when the market's changing, you need to have recent data. So you pick 3 months instead of 6 months in this particular market.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, the floor plan has to be similar to your floor plan. So if you have a two-story, they have to be two-story comps. Geographic area, you need to select homes that are 1 to 3 miles from your home. And lastly, in square footage is key. The square footage of the comparable homes needs to be roughly 10% plus or minus of your square footage.
So do most sellers get this kind of market analysis done before they, you know, take their house to market?
Sadly, I have to say no. And the evidence of that is that most homes that come on the market are overpriced, which means the broker and the seller have not done the thorough analysis of their competitive position of their home.
So why would they do that? Why wouldn't you prepare and plan and strategize on what the market has to offer before they're listing the home?
I think because there's a huge temptation on the part of the seller and the broker to overprice the home. And they overprice the home for two thoughts. One is, I've got to get maximum dollars, so I'm going to price it high. And two, they're both thinking, the broker and the seller, that I have to prepare for negotiations. I got to prepare for someone lowballing me, so I'm going to jack that price good and high when I go on the market.
Do you think that's going to change right now? Because it seems like the industry is getting a little bit smarter with where you have agents like yourself that have strategies, that they're actually going in and they're listing their homes low. Do you think the industry is getting a little smarter? Because I think part of it too, and correct me if I'm wrong, some agents, maybe it's the lack of experience or the confidence in their ability to communicate with the seller. They're just doing what the seller wants them to do. And the seller says, I want this for my house. And if you list it any lower, I'm going to go find another agent that's going to list it for more. Is that correct?
You hit it exactly. That is the dynamic that happens, I think, most of the time. The broker is anxious for the business.
Yep.
And so they bend to that pressure.
So if you're a seller, test your agent and see how strong and that they are. I mean, ask that, you know, because really that is the lack of confidence in the agent in communicating with their client, that they know what is best for the market. And look what's happening with the agents right now that are going out there and they're listing for a little bit under price.
Right.
What's happening? And that's what's causing all this multiple offers, right?
Exactly. Exactly. The agent's got to have a little toughness when it comes to telling their client, gosh, you need to price it at this price, not that price.
So have you ever walked away from a listing opportunity because you got the gut feeling that the seller was just not going to be reasonable?
I have several times.
Yeah.
It's hard to do when you're living off that commission, but I've had to do that several times.
Yeah.
If you're listening, you really need to have this conversation. I think this is the biggest conversation, the most important conversation you're going to have with your agent is, what are you going to list my home for? And you can get out there with technology now and all the online searches, and not to say that those online searches are going to give you accurate value, because they don't. And we speak from being in the mortgage arena. We know that. But doing some education and having that conversation with your realtor, show me the comps in my immediate area that just match exactly what the points that you went through.
Mm-hmm.
What have they sold for? That data is there, and it's so easy to get access to.
Yes.
And if you're a realtor, if that's what they should be coming to the table with, and listed a little tiny bit under
exactly
what is being priced right now in the market.
Exactly.
And you're going to get those multiple offers, right, Jerry?
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. In fact, sometimes I tell sellers, it's okay to price a hair below your competition, because then you look like a deal.
Yes.
And that fires up the emotion and the excitement about your home.
Right, because the other thing you got to realize too is that just because an offer comes in low, it doesn't mean you have to accept it, right? they don't know that there's not 3 or 4 other offers on the table, or that there's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So yeah, exactly what you guys are talking about. If you price it just under, that's going to cause people, it's going to get their attention. You know, the radar is going to go off to everybody.
Right.
And that's actually, if you really want to get into a bidding war on your home and get the actual maximum price, price it under.
Right.
And if it comes in low and it's the only low one, if you really need to, you can act like maybe there's other offers on your property. You don't have to take it, right? So
exactly.
You have nothing to lose by doing that.
Exactly. And in fact, it actually fires up your broker. When your broker knows it's priced competitively, the broker gets excited about serving you and finding a buyer who's going to sign on the dotted line.
So, Jerry, what else could you expect to happen when you price competitively?
Well, the second aspect to that is, amazingly, you will sell quicker. And by that, I mean, if you price competitively, your home is going to sell in about 30 days, plus or minus, whereas the average house sells in 60 to 90 days. You'll have your money quicker.
And if it's overpriced, how long is it going to take to sell in this market?
You're going to be 60, 90 days plus.
And then what happens?
Your house gets worn on the market, mm-hmm. and you end up selling for less than you would have if you had priced it right.
This is the biggest advice if you're listening today. If you don't hear anything else from this segment, you got to hear this. You have to price your home right. Sorry. If you don't, it's going to take longer to sell. It's going to have to be pulled off the market because buyers see that house and recognize the address and go, nah, that one is not worth what it's listed for, and you literally have to pull it off the market mm-hmm. and start all over and hope nobody remembers your home.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. In fact, when you're with buyers, many times the buyer, as you drive up to the house, the buyer says, how many days has this one been on the market?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. That is. They'll sort by that, right?
They do.
Yeah. And what's the first thing they start to think of if it's been on too long? They automatically think
they're going to go in low,
or they think there's something wrong with the house.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. They think it maybe it's gone through an inspection, mm-hmm. it never made it, and the house has been on the market for this time, and there must be something wrong with this property.
You said it exactly.
So, Jerry, do you have an example of this, of a home that's overpriced that you can share? Because I think it's really neat for people that are listening and don't have a visual, just bringing in those stories. Do you have one to share?
I do, actually, my own home. So I practice what I preach.
What? Go ahead,
so a number of years ago, I put my home on the market. I did my own market analysis to make sure I had it right. I put it on at the price, list price, and I had, you know, 3 showings, 5 showings, got up to 10 showings. I overpriced my own home.
Wow, okay? that's a great story, Jerry.
So 10 showings. The 11th showing came in. It was about 3 weeks down the road.
Uh-huh.
And I got a full price offer from the 11th shopper.
Wow.
And it was actually a textbook case of this principle of pricing competitively.
So what does this strategy mean as far as, in dollars to a client?
You know, in dollars, my experience is that you're going to sell for about 5% higher than you would have if you had overpriced it. And by that, I mean, I want to define that. By 5% higher, I mean, if you price competitively, you will sell for about 95% of your original list price, 95% or better. If you overprice, you're going to sell for probably 90% of your original list price.
So, Jerry, what about recent stories of home selling in a declining or dead market with the selling approach? Can you share an example of that?
I can. And I go back to my own experience. I sold one of my rental homes a couple years ago, so 2010. And let me set the stage here. 2010, prices are still plummeting. Mm-hmm. Homes are on the market for 6 months, 9 months or more. And I wanted to sell this. And I wanted to sell it because I wanted to cut my loss, right? So,
like a lot of people did.
Yes.
Yep.
So again, I did a thorough market analysis. In fact, this home was in Puyallup, so it was kind of out of my normal backyard. So I took the extra effort to spend a day down in Puyallup and get a thorough market analysis for myself. I priced it at X price. 5 showings and 17 days later, I had a full price offer in a declining market.
Wow.
So I know it wasn't underpriced, or I would have had 3 or 4 offers. And I know it wasn't overpriced because it sold in 3 weeks, mm-hmm, which is another mm-hmm. textbook case.
So what happens when people ignore this type of selling approach?
Okay, very good question. And I want the seller to try to imagine themselves, or one of your listeners to imagine themselves in this position. What happens is you're overpriced when you hit the market and you don't get very many showings, 1 or 2 or 0 for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So you as a homeowner get frustrated that no one's coming to view your home. You start getting irritated with your broker, thinking it's their fault.
And it is their fault because they didn't price it right.
Yes, true. So then you as a homeowner start pressuring your broker to advertise more. Do open houses, advertise. What are you doing to help bring people into my home?
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, the truth is, only competitive pricing will bring a buyer into your home who will buy your home, who will actually buy it. Advertising does not accomplish that. It's pricing it competitively.
So, Jerry, I think we've really drilled into our listeners that price is the most important thing of listing your home. You have to price it right. Mm-hmm. It's easy to find out what's going on in your market. And I think it's, you know, when you're thinking of selling your home too, you should be actually physically and not depending on your agent doing this, which they should be doing it as well. Mm-hmm. But get out of your house.
Yes.
And get into the homes that are in your area, physically mm-hmm. walk into their homes.
Yes.
see what they have that your house doesn't. Then, you know, gather that data, getting back with your realtor and find out how your home's going to be adjusted according to that.
You're exactly right. What you want to do is just have a conversation with your broker and double check and say, hey, what about this home down the street?
Yeah.
That often happens.
And why would they not do that? Why are they not getting in and seeing what your competition is?
Well, it is. And many homeowners do that. They say, hey, Jerry, did you catch the one down the street that sold 3 months ago?
So, okay. Yeah. Okay. So we talked about price. You had also mentioned about the condition of your home or the how you're presenting it. Let's go into a little more detail with that.
Right. I think there's two principles. One, and the most important principle is do not spend too much money fixing up the house.
Okay.
Oftentimes, homeowners think they have to remodel a kitchen or do all new flooring. You don't. You need to just spruce up the house to make it clean and sparkly and acceptable, but it does not have to be remodeled or a lot of money spent.
What about things like the yard? Low-cost things that you can do to actually make, you know, the curb appeal?
Exactly. Low-cost things are get a lawn service there to green up your lawn and throw in some fresh bark and pull the weeds, and that's it. Just make it look presentable.
The simple things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The simple things.
And you hear a lot, too, in the advice as far as the interior, taking some of the personal things down, making it more approachable or more visual for someone to imagine themselves and their family in there.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because a third principle is to declutter the home.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get stuff put in boxes and put in the garage.
Yep.
Get rid of the large pieces of furniture that you can live without for a few months. So what you want to do is make the house look a little sparse. It makes it feel roomy and a little more welcoming.
And what about the, you know, like some nice sounding jazz music, some nice smells that are, you know, have not overwhelming, but something that maybe baking those cookies.
You're exactly
small
right.
Things like that can make a huge difference, right?
They can. And not many homeowners do that, but just some soft music in the background.
And baking some cookies.
And baking
Who
some
doesn't
cookies?
Like the smell of cookies and make you feel like you're at home, right?
Exactly. You said it.
It's all psychological.
Exactly. You heard it right here on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer.
So,
Jerry, how do our listeners get a hold of you? If someone's thinking of selling their home or they need advice as far as a purchase of a new home, how can they connect with you?
You bet, Tina. It's easy. Calljerry.com. Calljerry.com. Jerry
that,
with a J.
That is easy. Calljerry.com, and that's with a J. And you can always call our show, 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090. Mike and I will get you directly in contact with Jerry.
So, Jerry, quick question also for you. I hear this all the time. It cracks me up. What do you say to people when they try to beat you up on your commission? Because it happens, right?
It does. And thank you. It happens often. And what I tell them is, if you allow me to price your home competitively, you will sell your home for about 5% more than you would have if you hadn't. And that 5% pays for my commission.
Bingo.
That's a good point.
That's it.
So, Jerry, what advice would you have if somebody is thinking of selling their home, but they're not sure that they're going to get top dollar, or they may be waiting? What type of advice do you have as far as what you see the market doing? I mean, nobody has a crystal ball, but we all have our opinion.
Yes.
Where do you think our market is heading?
I think our market is heading for continued price increases. And the reason I say that is the inventory is still historically low, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have a slightly recovering economy, and we have buyer psychology that's changing. A lot of the fear has gone out of the buyer community. So you have a renewed buyer volume coming into the marketplace with still a depressed inventory of homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that equals price increases. And I think the inventory will remain low for the next 3 to 6 months until equities increase. So with continued low inventory and increased buyer demand, prices will continue to elevate.
And with QE3, oh my gosh,
yeah.
With these rates like this, I mean, it's unbelievable to see what's happening right now. Also, I get this question a lot from my clients that are coming back. Mike and I have a mortgage practice, and that's what we do. And it's nice, you know, hearing from the other side of the table as far as an experienced realtor like yourself to see the advice. But I get a lot of clients that come back, and they're thinking of moving up buyers. And I've talked about this in studio before, where they go, you know what, Tina, I'm thinking of moving up, but I don't want to sell right now because I feel that the market might drop a little bit, and we're saying chances are it's probably not going to, but I like to bring this point up because there's never a buyer's and seller's market at the same time.
Right.
And it's either going to be either or a buyer's market or a seller's market. And today we're in definitely a
seller's market.
Now, if it were swapped around and we were a little more of a buyer's market. Would it be advisable to sell your home when you're moving up? And what I tell my clients is that is a huge opportunity to do that. If you have to buy and sell at the same time,
right,
the best option would be to sell in a seller's market,
yes,
and to buy in a buyer's market. But
yes,
most people have to do both at they have to do them at the same time.
Right.
So just if you just do the simple math, and if you're buying up and you're buying a $500,000 home and you're trading in a $200,000 home, what market would you rather be doing that in?
Right.
Because you're not going to get the best deal on both properties, right?
Right, exactly.
And then you tie into as far as interest rates and what's happening with the rates. So it's just a fun conversation to have in advising when you're thinking of moving up. So if someone's thinking of buying and selling at the same time right now, being in a seller's market, what would be your advice?
My advice would be to try to hone back on the greed factor.
Okay.
And if you need to sell, go ahead and go on the market and sell, and don't put off your life plans for 6 months hoping to get a higher price for your house.
Good point.
You may indeed get a higher price in December or January, February, but stick with your life plan that you need to progress through,
mm-hmm,
and go on the market even though you see prices increasing in the months ahead.
Okay.
So Jerry, one of the things that's really interesting is now in this market, you have this influx of people coming in that these people have been homeowners, you know, almost, you know, maybe for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And unfortunately, due to the market crash, they've maybe lost their home, a short sale, or maybe a foreclosure. So over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, they've been renting. But now that those years have passed, and as far as lending guidelines and credit goes, they're ready to get back out there and buy again. You actually have them competing now with your typical first-time home buyer who's never bought before. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic going on.
Interesting you bring that up. I have more first-time buyer clients right now than I think I've ever had in my 19-year career.
Yeah, I say, isn't that amazing? It's exciting, isn't it?
It is very exciting. Yeah. They're anxious. They're tired of renting, and they're actually a little frustrated because there's not enough inventory really to choose from. So they're all of them are anxious.
So on that note, because I've talked in studio about shadow inventory, what do you think of shadow inventory? Is it going to hit us? What's going on with that shadow inventory?
You know, we've been looking for the shadow inventory since 2007,
and especially in March when the $25 billion national mortgage settlement came out. It's like, okay, here's the shadow inventory. It's going to come now, right? Right? It's still not here.
Yeah.
Where is it?
I think the banks have done a good job of piecemealing their inventory out in the last 5 years.
And now they're selling in, you know, the bulk properties, which we just got notification of the first bulk properties that were sold to investor for renting. So it's funny how things just continue to kind of seem to work out, at least in our arena.
Yes.
With real estate and home prices.
Right.
So you're not really seeing any sort of a slowdown, right? Because obviously the spring and summer are usually hot markets,
right,
for people to try to sell their home.
Right.
And then as you get back into the fall, kids start going back into school. Technically, you've seen patterns in the past, right, where that slows down.
Right.
How are we looking in our local market between now and the end of this year?
I think the factor of unusually low inventory dominates the normal seasonal pattern. So we'll continue to see a hot market through the balance of the year.
Great.
So, Jerry, to wrap things up, what is final advice that you have for anybody that's listening right now in selling or buying? Some final advice you can leave our listeners with.
If you're a seller, do not hold off selling expecting a higher price 3 or 6 months from now. Activate your life plan by getting your home on the market as you need to and be happy with the sale price that you do attain. If you're a buyer, I would not sit around waiting. You need to get in the market and buy now because prices are going up and will continue to go up for the near future.
So follow your life plan. Don't wait to hit the bottom of the market. Just like the stock market, chances are there's a good chance you could probably lose.
Right.
And if you're thinking of buying, buy right now. All-time historical lower interest rates.
Yes.
No disagreeing there. You can get an awesome deal on a home.
Right.
No disagreeing there.
Right.
And if you're a renter and you're listening, I'm going to say it again right here on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. There is no other investment out on the market that if you don't decide to pay for, you're going to have to pay for it anyways. That's my final say with you, all of you renters out there. So give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-776-1090, or you can reach us online at themoneyhour.com. Jerry, how do they connect with you?
Call Jerry with a J, calljerry.com.
Calljerry.com. So coming up next, if you're worried about retirement, don't go anywhere. We have right here on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, Mark Peterson with Ameriprise. And he is here to help guide you along the path to and through retirement. We'll be right back, right here on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer.
Are you concerned that your nest egg is not enough for retirement?
Do you have enough money to last the rest of your life? Mark Peterson with Ameriprise Financial has prepared individuals for retirement and protected their nest egg during retirement during the market's ups and downs. He specializes in creating and protecting wealth for individuals in order for his clients to realize their goals and dreams.
To learn more about how I can assist you in achieving your goals, please call me, Mark Peterson, with Ameriprise Financial at 206-926-5364, or you can email me at mark.n.peterson@ampf.com. That's 206-926-5364, or email mark.n.peterson@ampf.com.
Now back to the Money Hour on AM 1090 with your host Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. The purpose of our show is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090 or online at themoneyhour.com. So, Tina, I'm really excited to introduce Mark Peterson with Ameriprise Financial. Mark is a Washington native and United States Naval Academy graduate. He is a father of five beautiful and very energetic children.
Girls or boys?
So I have two boys and three girls.
I was going to say, because we had Jerry just in studio, he had five girls. You both have five kids?
Must be pretty common.
Oh my gosh, that is great. Sorry, Mike, for the introduction the interruption to the bio.
And I know we asked this last time, are you guys done? I think there's maybe one more to come, right?
I got to check with my wife on that one.
But Mark has been working to help individuals plan and enjoy retirement for the past 12 years at Ameriprise Financial and has been personally investing in the market for over 22 years. Mark is a certified financial planner, a chartered retirement planner, and an accredited portfolio manager advisor. He is also working on his master's of science in financial planning. Mark, very excited to have you on the show.
Thank you all for having me.
And excited to talk about retirement, because I think that's a big topic for conversation in your arena, especially in today's economy. People are worried about retirement. I think, you know, would you say the number one worry is that people think they're going to run out of money?
That's exactly right. We're seeing more and more folks actually delay retirement because they're concerned about how much money that they have. And a lot of times they're not sure how much money they need.
So if we were talking about an average person, Mark, how does an average person prepare and know how much they need to retire?
Well, it's fairly easy to do. If you take a look at your expenses and actually calculate what your monthly expenses are and determine how much money you have from investments, pensions, and Social Security.
Mark, would you say that inflation would come into the picture as far as preparing for retirement? Because I think a lot of people don't realize, I mean, we all know that inflation on an average is, what, maybe 3%?
Right. So the CPI index tracks inflation right around 3%. And if we think about that, it doesn't seem like a lot. But if you think about what a stamp was in the 1980s compared to what it is today, you know, you're looking at almost double the amount that you paid for stamps.
That's a good point. So if you look at an example, let's just say that you make $50,000 a year and you need to retire in 10 years. You need to have $65,000 in income in 10 years to keep up with the 3% inflation.
Well, it's
right?
Not,
is that how that works?
Really, really close. It's not how much money that you make that determines when you can retire. It really depends on how much you're actually spending on a monthly basis.
So that's a good point. So if you're looking at a comparison, so here's you either have to have the income come in or you have to lower your spending. So if you're looking at what your income is now and your budget is going to stay the same, your expenses are going to stay the same. $50,000 would be $65,000 10 years from now, or $50,000 would be $87,000 20 years from now if we're looking at 3% appreciation and your spending is not changing. Is that correct, Mark?
Exactly.
Okay.
So what is the term calculating your gap? What does that mean as far as financial planning terms?
So ideally, every individual is making X amount of dollars and they're spending X amount of dollars. The difference between what they're spending and what they're making is basically the gap. And when you go into retirement, what ends up happening is what you're spending typically remains the same or drops a little bit less. And what you need to have is income to actually cover that. The difference between what you receive currently from pensions, Social Security, and your investment income compared to what you're spending is actually your gap.
So if we talk a little bit more about the gap, How do you go into saving for that?
Give you an example. Let's say currently you're spending around $50,000, and between your pensions and Social Security and investment income, you're able to bring in around $40,000.
Okay.
So in that situation, your gap right now is $10,000 or $833 per month. So if retirement's next year, you need to lower your expenses in order to retire. If it's 10 years from now, then you would know you need to be able to provide an additional $833 per month of income going forward to retire at your current situation.
And that is an important point, Mark. I mean, I think if you're listening, the biggest thing is you have to come up with that budget. You have to determine what you're going to be spending in your retirement years. And a lot of people, I know myself, I would hope that I'm going to have money to enjoy my retirement, which means that your spending could actually change and maybe increase if you're going to be traveling and doing other things. So I think it's important to put together that budget, calculate in what you think maybe inflation might be to determine the income that you have to have in order to retire and enjoy your golden years.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tina. Actually, what we see a lot of times is during the first 5 years of retirement, people are actually spending sometimes 110 to 120% more than what they're spending working. Because mm-hmm. now instead of going to the job and working, you know, 40 to 60 hours a week, they have free time. Mm-hmm, so they mm-hmm. like to travel, like to go on some of those vacations up to Alaska or down to Mexico. And so in order to provide for that, they want to save a little bit more.
What is the average age, as far as your clients are concerned, that people are actually retiring these days?
What I'm seeing is folks that actually work for the government or have defined pensions tend to retire a little bit earlier than folks that are having to save on their own. And I think a lot of that has to do with we went through kind of a change where folks were working, you know, 20 or 30 years at the same job and they had pensions. These days, people are really relying on themselves to save. Mm-hmm. So in order to save, either through their 401k or on their own, they're having to actually work a little bit longer.
Yeah, I was going to say in this economy, we have to see that number, that average age that people are retiring is increasing. And I think it's probably going to get worse, right?
And you're also seeing a lot more people go back to work.
Yeah. Isn't that sad when you walk into a grocery store and you see somebody in their, you know, their late 60s bagging groceries? I mean, it's sad to see that there. And I think a lot of that, too, is because people are living longer, right?
Well, definitely. Folks are living a lot longer now. So when Social Security was set up, you know, the average person actually passed away at 63. They collected benefits at 65.
Yep.
Now you're seeing folks live into the 80s or 90s. I mean, yep. There's over 100,000 people over the age of 100 just live in the U.S. alone.
And if you're a girl listening, the chances that we're going to live even longer. Our husband may not be there. We lose, you know, we lose their income and we're going to still be living for another 10 years. So it's not a funny subject, but it's something that we need to think about. And girls do live longer, right, Mark?
They definitely do.
Yeah.
So how much does a person really need to save? I mean, how do you really map that out with them?
That's a great question. So once you've actually determined how much is coming in from your pensions, 401k, and Social Security, and you've determined what your actually gap is, and then what you can actually do is sit down and figure out, okay, if I need to create an additional $10,000 of income in retirement, then you can actually back that back and say, okay, I need to save X amount of dollars on a monthly basis in order to overcome the gap that I've created for myself.
So what about of various options as far as a person that they can actually invest in?
So there are a lot of different options out there. We hear about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, CDs. In the current environment right now, we see a lot of folks just putting money in checking and savings account because they're scared of actually investing in the market.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem with that, though, is you're receiving a 1% rate of return, and we know that inflation is a little over 3%. So in reality, you're actually losing money by just keeping all your money in the savings account. In terms of the type of investment, really depends upon your risk tolerance. If you're a more aggressive investor, then you can look at some of the stocks or high yield bonds. If you're more conservative, then you want to stay with things that are a little bit more conservative.
And how often do you meet with your clients? What do you typically recommend for kind of a checkup?
You should be meeting with your financial advisor, at least having a conversation with them a minimum 4 times a year, probably physically sitting down with them, going over your situation at least twice a year, just so, you know, things change in our life, our decisions change, what we want to do. And so just keeping your advisor up to date on what's going on in your life really helps.
If you're listening today and you think you might need a second opinion or you need an advisor to talk to, pick up the phone, give Mark Peterson a call. You can reach him at 206-926-5364. As always, you can call our show at 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090, and we can connect you with Mark. Mark, can you go into a little more details on the investment tools, kind of lay those out for our listeners?
Definitely. There are very different options that folks can actually use to save. Majority of the folks have a 401k or a defined benefit plan if they work. You can also invest into a traditional IRA, a Roth IRA. You have the options of simple plans or annuities or a SEP plan. Really depends if you're a small business owner or an employee.
Can you, if somebody's listening, because I think annuities, I mean, not to give any advice on investments, because I know that, you know, you can't do that, but just in explaining on annuities, because there's some huge opportunities, and there's a difference between a deferred annuity versus an income annuity. Can you give the difference between those two?
Definitely. First thing I want to say, though, is that there's a lot of talk about annuities, and some people say out there that annuities are horrible. Keep in mind that the largest annuity in the world is our Social Security system. So all pensions are also annuities.
Wow. I learned something new every single day in studio.
Primary difference between income annuities and deferred annuities is when you actually receive the money. So typically, you can put money into an immediate annuity, and it automatically provides you with a stream of income. That can actually be very beneficial if we go back to the gap that we talked about earlier. Ideally, you'd like to have all your fixed expenses covered by income that you know is going to come in on a monthly basis. And that's where sometimes annuities can come in to actually fit that situation.
So you need, again, this is a part that's filling that gap, right, that we talked about?
Exactly.
You need to have something. If your Social Security, your pension is not going to be enough, and you've got that gap, an annuity is an opportunity to potentially fill the gap.
Exactly. Imagine, Tina, if, you know, when you wake up after day one of retirement and you know that all your expense, all your fixed expenses are covered with income that you can rely upon, you don't really have to worry about if the market's up 300 points or if it's down 500 points. You can go about your lifestyle and not worry about what's happening with the market.
So, Mark, can you touch on briefly the difference between some of the different life insurance policies that are out there? Because I know that question comes up quite a bit. And obviously, you know, if people are into their late 30s, approaching their 40s, if they haven't done it already, it's probably a pretty good time to at least look at that as an option. But I know there's so many different kinds. Can you touch on a couple of, I guess, maybe the more popular ones?
Definitely. The first thing to think about is all insurance is term insurance. Okay, so term insurance is basically when you pay an insurance company X amount of dollars and they provide you a benefit for a set period of time. If you break it down a little bit further, you have term insurance that is fixed for either 10, 20, or 30-year time periods. You also hear about permanent insurance. Permanent insurance is still term insurance. The only difference is you're actually prepaying for the higher cost of insurance earlier than later. When you go into permanent insurance, there's three different types of permanent insurance. You have whole life insurance, and this is typically where the investor is going to receive somewhere between a 2 to 4% rate of return, and that's provided by the insurance company. The insurance company is actually taking the risk of investing in the market. The next step is what's called universal life insurance. Universal life insurance, there's a potential for a little bit higher rate of return. Once again, though, the risk is taken by the insurance company. The next step is actually what's called variable universal life insurance. And instead of having the insurance company take the risk on the investments, the actual owner of the policy will be taking the risk.
So your arena is just like mine and Mike's arena. It's all about options, understanding what the options are, comparing them, looking at the pros and cons, understanding the cost, and ultimately what's going to fit your best financial plan.
And the risk, right?
And the risk, risk, yeah. Absolutely, so that you're just lining it out and you can make the right decision for you and your family.
Exactly. There is no bad investment tool out there. It's just a matter of how they're used. For every individual, there's a good plan to set up in place. It's really sitting down with a financial advisor and talking through what you want to do, what your goals and dreams are, and determining based upon that what's the best mix for you.
So, Mark, to make sure that you don't run out of money in your retirement years, when is it too late for somebody to, if they haven't met with somebody like you already, when does it really become too late?
It's never too late to actually meet with a financial planner. The longer you wait, though, more than likely the longer it's going to take you to retire and reach your goals.
There might be an answer of better investments depending on where you're at in retirement. I mean, depending on where you're at and how far you are, is there a better investment for the younger people versus people that are getting closer to retirement age?
So,
is that too broad of a question to ask in studio?
No, it's a good question. Investments and what's best for somebody is really based upon the risk tolerance and their time horizon. An example of that is if you're looking to purchase a car in 2 years, you probably don't want to be in an internet stock. Conversely, if you are in your mid-30s or early 40s and you have, you know, a 20-year time frame, then you can go into some of the higher risk investments because you still have time to recover if there's a downturn in the market.
Okay.
Hey, Mark, can you touch on investments that are protected against, you know, future taxes?
If you're looking for some investments where you can actually defer some of the taxes, there's basically three different options. You can look at a Roth IRA, and so that's not so much an investment as opposed to a box that you can put investments into. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, if you are under the age of 50, the limit's $5,000. If you're over the age of 50, you can put up to $6,000. There's also some income limits involved with the Roth IRA. The next option is variable universal life insurance policies. Those are a great option. There is a insurance piece to that. In addition, though, you want to make sure that it's properly funded, and it'd be best to talk to an insurance specialist or financial advisor as opposed to going out and buying one on your own. The third option is basically municipal bonds. And municipal bonds, that's where you receive the income on a tax-free basis.
So if you're listening today and there's just something that sounds interesting, that if you want to learn opportunities of how to possibly fund your retirement, different products mean different things to different people. And it's really all about the advice. And you heard it from Mark. I mean, it's there's not bad products. There's bad advice and lack of knowledge of understanding. So you really need to specifically find out what's best for your financial future. Pick up the phone. Give Mark a call, 206-926-5364. You can also call the show at 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090. Mark, what about 401k? Let's say you've maxed your 401k based on the contribution for your company, because I think everybody probably would want to take advantage of that. And let's go after that, after you've had your maximum contribution. Most people, I understand that you're not paying taxes right now on the 401k, any money that you're putting into your 401k, but you do pay taxes when you take it out. What are the chances when people, that strategy actually doesn't work so well, because when they take their money out of their 401k, we're in higher tax brackets? They don't have their mortgage write-off. A lot of different things could come into play. Any feedback that you have on that?
Well, they actually introduced something new to 401k. So there's a Roth component to a 401k these days. And so one of the great things, you can take a look at it, where traditionally we just throw everything into a 401k, uh-huh, and try to maximize it out. You can actually really sit down and take a look at it and say, okay, if I put maybe half towards a Roth component to a 401k versus putting all of it into a traditional, and what that allows you to do is really put your money into kind of three different tax buckets. So the first tax bucket is where you pay no taxes right up front. It's tax deferred. Then when it comes out after the age of 59 and a half or retirement, then you pay 100% taxes.
Okay.
The next bubble you can kind of look at is what you pay taxes when you invest, and then you also pay taxes when it comes out. And so an example of that would be like your checking accounts, savings accounts.
Okay, that doesn't sound too good, does it?
But that's how a lot of people invest, actually.
Okay, all right.
The third bucket, and we touched on this a little bit earlier when we talked about tax-deferred investments, is when you actually put money in on an after-tax basis, it grows tax-deferred, and then it can come out 100% tax-free. Mm-hmm. By taking a mixture of all three of those buckets, it's a way you can actually minimize the amount of taxes you pay in the future, regardless of what the current tax rates are.
So, Mark, what about the timeline as far as the market versus buying, you know, the buy-and-hold strategy? Can you share a little bit on that?
So the buy and hold strategy was excellent when you have a market that's continuously going up. The problem with the market these days right now is we're very volatile. So, you know, it's going up and down. And when you have a situation like that, you really want to have a portfolio that is taking advantage of the different ups and downs that you see in the market, as opposed to just buying a specific stock or a mutual fund or a bond and just hanging on to it for a long time. The market's changing so much. We're seeing so much turmoil in terms of what's happening in the world, that having an active managed portfolio is really beneficial to you.
So, Mark, we might have someone listening out there that has a concern that I think a lot of, especially nearing retirement, people do, is long-term care. What suggestions and tips do you have in regards to concerns that people may have on long-term care?
So long-term care is becoming more and more of a concern as we're seeing individuals live longer and longer, and as their lifestyle.
We just keep on living.
They just keep on living. And, you know, traditionally, you know, folks would move into a nursing home and, you know, 2 or 3 years later that they'd pass on. These days, you know, the long-term care piece of life can last, you know, 10 or 15 years, even when you add in home care, assisted living, as well as nursing homes. A biggest benefit right now is to really decide what you want to do with your money. If you want to spend, you know, all your money taking care of yourself, if you want to pass it on, if you want to give to a charity, and determining on how you're going to spend your money is going to determine what type of long-term care policy you should have, or if you need one.
Okay.
Do people ask you a lot in regards to, you know, their pensions, if they should take it in one lump sum?
That's a great question, and a lot of that really depends upon how the pension is set up. Some pensions have a cost of living adjustment. Some of them don't. You really want to take a close look at that or have a financial advisor take a look at your pension options. Some of the pension options actually have a spousal benefit. We talked a little bit earlier how, you know, when girls are living much longer than guys. Mm-hmm. And so if the primary bread earner is a male and he's got the pension, if you take a lump sum, you may or may not have the option of having a spousal benefit in which you invest in later.
That's a good point, Mark. We've talked a little bit about asset allocation. How may that change or differ when you get closer to retirement?
The biggest downfall or pitfall that I see right now is folks, as they're getting closer and closer to retirement, tend to be much more conservative. That's great if you're only going to live 4 or 5 years into retirement. These days, when people retire, they're living 30 years on. So if you imagine what your portfolio was like when you were in your early 30s, it may not change that much when you're in your 60s if you're going to live until 90 or 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I think it goes back to what a person's risk tolerance is and how much are they willing to risk and the lifespan.
Mark, next to procrastination, what would you say is the biggest mistake, you know, people make when it comes to retirement investing?
I think the biggest mistake that people make is thinking that they need a lot of money to invest. So the key to actually doing good retirement planning is just starting to save. I mean, even if it's $25 or $5, just starting the habit of saving. You know, if you're in your 40s or 50s, 30s, or even 20s, building that habit, and you can increase it as time goes. The longer you wait to start, the longer it is before you can retire.
So that's a good point, Mark. We might have somebody driving in their car right now listening to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. They just heard you say that, and they're just feeling bad that they feel that they have waited too long. What do you do?
First thing, if you have a job where there's a 401k, start. Most 401ks have a match. If you're an independent contractor, if you're a small business owner, see about setting a little bit aside. You can start with as little as even putting, you know, $5, $10 into a savings account. You really just want to focus on starting savings. And then as you take a look at your budget and you can free up more money, then you can continue to save and grow and then actually cover the gap that we talked about earlier.
So I happen to know that you are fortunate enough to be in a place in your practice right now where you're not necessarily going after new clients. Most of the people that come to you now are strictly by referral only. But I'm assuming that if people called into our show, right, Mitchell and Mercer, The Money Hour, and they requested to set up a time to meet or speak with you, that you would you'd offer that, wouldn't you?
Definitely. So anybody that wants to sit down and talk with me, I'll be more than happy to sit down with them for a half hour and just talk about their situation. Talk about what their needs are, what their gap is, and what they can do to get themselves getting close to retirement. In addition, if there's folks that are in retirement that are uncomfortable with how things are going, I'll be more than happy to take a look at their portfolio and give them a couple options.
Thanks for letting me put you on the spot like that.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Give our show a call, 1-888-776-1090. We'll hook you up with Mark. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090. You can call him directly at 206-926-5364. Mark, thank you so much. You're another first time. We've had two first timers here in studio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, awesome information. We look forward to having you back. And next week in studio, I'm not going to even tell you who's next week in studio. It's going to be a big, big surprise. You just won't want to miss it. We have two more awesome guests, awesome topics that they're going to introduce, and you definitely want to be here.
This is Mike Mercer signing off for Miss Tina Mitchell, the Mortgage Diva.
And this is Tina Mitchell signing off for the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer. Enjoy your weekend, everyone. It's a little bit cooler out there. We've gotten rid of that hot, hot weather that we had earlier in the week. I'm missing summer. I feel like it's going away. Thanks for spending your Saturday here with us. Don't miss next Saturday right here on AM 1090 for the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Have a great weekend.
We'll see you then.